afternoon. So last time we started by talking about monitors, which is what we called the combination of a lock, these condition variables, and some shared data. And we learned that condition variables were kind of an abstraction of a list of waiting threads, the idea being that they'd all be waiting for the same event to happen. And we take advantage of this to wake up those waiting threads, have them start running again when something changed about the thing they were waiting for. We had this scheme with monitors where we combine this with a lock and some shared data, with the idea being that the conditions that they were waiting for would be based on this shared data. We needed a lock to make sure we didn't have race conditions where a thread decided, oh, I need to wait, or oh, I don't need to wait, and then the thing they were checking changed. So the lock prevents that from happening by forcing us to take turns reading or modifying that thing being checked. And this gave us this pattern to use this. Here's my interesting. Use this tool to implement our sort of synchronization. And basically what we do is we lock this lock. We check whether we need to wait based on the data that we always use the lock before checking or modifying. And while we needed to wait still, we'd keep checking the condition. We learned that we needed a while loop here because it turns out that the wait function can wake us up at, you know, stop waiting at times we don't want it to. We saw two reasons for this. One was this thing called spurious wake-ups, where it's sometimes just wakes us up randomly. And the other was that we figure out, oh, the thread should be able to go now, doesn't mean that they'll still be able to go by the time they actually get to running, because there's this gap in time where some other stuff can squeeze in and change the thing they're waiting for. Once we're done waiting, we do some operation, and then we do some checking to figure out, well, we know some other threads might be waiting. Let's see if we change the thing they're waiting for, and if so, or if we might have changed it, signal or broadcast them to make them keep going. Some questions about things we covered last time. Okay. So I'll briefly talk about anonymous feedback. So one person saying I should proofread quizzes. So I actually had multiple TAs look at that last quiz. I would love to make this more effective. I'm thinking about how to do that. I don't think it was as bad as it sounded, because the main issue was that barrier weight could be called what we didn't expect. That's just a makes it annoying to grade issue. There's just an additional set of correct answers to questions 3 and 4. And now we have to grade question 4, looking at question 3. Doable, that's what I'm hoping we will be, our graders will be doing, or sure. The idea of modifying N and M I mentioned, very few students saw. So, didn't affect things much. But yes, I agree I'd like to prevent that, but it's not that we aren't doing any proofreading of quizzes. The main issue is that they're on a tight time scale, and maybe I'm not enforcing that we are having people like practice taking the quizzes and things like that, which would help more. So other question, would I mind slowing down speaking in lecture? I will try to keep an eye on that. I know I can speak quickly. And some positive. Okay. So we talked about monitors. Let's do a little exercise. Let's say I want to add a consume to function. So we had our producer consumer example. Let's say I want to have a consume to function that rather than getting one thing, gets a pair of values. What should I change? And importantly, we want it to be the case that we don't have this problem where if I add two values and have two salts to consume two, they shouldn't just hang forever because each of them got one item. So how do I implement that? you the whole time. I think you check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the strategy, what a strategy, there's multiple ways of doing it, should be. And I guess to expand on this, there's kind of two versions, there's different types of solutions you do if you assume consume two is replacing consume versus if you think both of them need to happen at the same time, which is obviously the second is more complicated. The simplest thing is, what if we just replace consume with this new consume two? Question. Can you modify produce? Yes. Yeah, I just want to know all the changes. You can add global variables, all the changes we need. Who would like some more time? Okay, so anyone have a proposal for something we could do to make this change? Yeah?
Does that mean the while loop and then dequeuing from the buffer after the first item is buffered and then those items?
So your idea is to basically duplicate this code? Okay, so that will make consume two work when we have one copy running at a time. When we have two, unfortunately, that can get us into this situation, that we could have two calls to consume two, A and B, where we have the first one gets the first item, then the second one gets the next item, and they're both waiting for another item to be produced, which is not what we wanted. So that, like, at least doesn't cause any inconsistencies, but it means that we're waiting in cases where I wanted to try to avoid that. So is there a way we can avoid that? Yeah.
So instead of checking when the buffer is has one thing, then check for
Yeah, so the other idea is, the reason we have that problem is that we were dequeuing from the buffer when there was only one thing, and that meant we could have sort of leave another call to consume two stranded without that thing. So the observation is, well, we don't need to consume until there's more things, so we can change this to be check the buffer size. Well, there's not two things to dequeue, and the queue an additional thing. So we have item one, and item two is going to be the queuing. And I have a written out version of that solution with one other change that is not strictly necessary, but is an optimization of not signaling when there's nothing on there if we're replacing consume. If I'm not signaling, isn't what overkill?
Well, if you're only sending a signal if the buffer size is greater than one, and you're only and then you're checking the buffer size again, isn't that double?
So the question is, you're saying, gosh, we're doing these two different checks of the buffer size. Could we avoid that? Probably. The idea of doing the check in produce, that seems redundant, is that my assumption is that it's kind of expensive to wake up consume if it doesn't have anything to do, and it's pretty easy for me to find out it doesn't have anything to do. So my assumption here is that buffer.size is really fast, so it's pretty easy to check it. If buffer.size is doing something like going through a linked list, probably we shouldn't do that. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
This consumes two, but would it consume two consecutive items off the queue?
Question, would it consume two consecutive items off the queue? And the answer is guaranteed to be yes. So, and how do we figure it out? Well, we see the two DQ calls are right after each other. So then the only question is, can something somehow in another thread happen in between those two? And the answer to that is going to be no because of this lock. So as long as we make sure we acquire the lock before calling DQ, yeah, they're two consecutive items. Yes?
Just making sure the answer to the first question. If somehow the buffer.size is much more expensive than trying to wake up the thread, so in the produce function, we should just take out the if statement.
Right? If we don't want to call buffer.size here, we could just take out the if, yeah. Though we'd still be doing the buffer.size check regardless, so maybe we aren't really saving anything.
That would be only in consume two, right?
That would only be in consume two, but consume two would do the check even when it's not going to be true. Right. So I would say if I were implementing this, the optimal solution is use a buffer that can track its size efficiently, which is not hard to do. Because even if it's a linked list, right, you can have separately do the bookkeeping to track the size without iterating through the list, for example.
And the reason for there must be a check of that even in consume two is because we must put in a while loop because the wait function is kind of flawed.
The reason we have the check is because the wait function, is kind of flawed, yes. And even if it's not flawed, as we mentioned last time, we could imagine we get woken up because there's two things for us to get, but sometime in between when we're woken up and we actually run, another call of consume two runs and takes those two things from us. So even if we didn't have that kind of sloppiness of the wait function, we have the sloppiness of getting the lock next, not necessarily being us, meaning someone else could sneak in and steal the items before we take them. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned when talking about this that this is the solution assuming it replaces. We can also do something where it doesn't replace. So one way of doing that is we could have sort of a separate conditioned variable for the waiting one item available versus two items available. And basically we have two copies of the logic, the one item logic we started with, and we have a new condition variable for the new logic, and we make our produce function check whether both conditions are likely to be true. Another option is that, and I guess to clarify why this is happening, so this is here, our produce function in this new version And we have these two different condition variables. So we have the list of threads waiting for one thing, list of threads waiting for two things, and it checks whether each of those conditions are likely true now, and then wakes up a thread to let them get some items. And sometimes we're going to wake up threads getting two items when they'll lose the race and not get them. And I've just decided to not try to handle that precisely, though maybe we could avoid waking up consume two when we know consume should win. If that could do that, we'd have to do some extra bookkeeping. Right? Because right now, I'm just waking things up, guessing there might be a thread waiting. If I wanted to like only do it when it was likely to be necessary, I need to know, is someone waiting for one item or not? Which we could track, but I'm not. So questions on this solution? Yeah. So the question is, if we have a calls to consume and consume two, doesn't this scheme kind of naturally favor the calls to consume? I think that is accurate, yes. So if we wanted to avoid that, we could do that. And the way I would do that is I would have like a counter saying, you know, int number of consume twos. And I'd have some sort of check here, you know, to, you know, and no consume twos here, basically. And I'd also track the number of consume twos by having consume two update that counter. So that would be one way I could say, if it's not acceptable to me that consume kind of beats consume two, I can fix that by explicitly tracking, are people trying to consume two right now, and saying consume is going to give way to those people when the tracking says, yes, there are. Does that answer your question? And this kind of idea that we can, you know, if we want to make priority decisions, we can just do bookkeeping to say, you know, who's doing what, and just have like basically, you know, our while loop say, oh, if someone's doing that, they go first, we wait for them. We can do that sort of thing, and we can basically implement kind of any policy we want with condition variables. Just we just have to do the bookkeeping ourselves and like write down the explicit, you know, when do we wait decisions. And I guess, oh, sorry. There's one detail I missed that you would need to implement the scheme favoring consume to over consume, which is that we should, you know, also we should signal the one ready here, because let's say there are three things on the queue and we consume two of them. We want to make sure that the consumes don't wait forever for us. We want them to figure out, oh, there's something there now, I should look at it, look for it. And if we were more sophisticated, maybe we could make them do that, realize there's an odd number of things, and do that earlier. But a key, I think, yeah, that we need not forget is that, oh, after consume two, if we want consume to go then, they were waiting for us to go first. We need to signal them because we changed whether they can make progress or not. So, some questions? And I'll mention, so in this solution, I kind of separated things out into these two condition variables, so these two lists of threads waiting for different things. We can also implement this sort of same functionality in a more sloppy way with one condition variable where I'm going to broadcast to it and say, we'll just let the threads figure out if they can go themselves. We're not going to bother doing the detailed checking of the size and all those conditions. So questions? on our consume two solutions. Okay, so one other thing we want to talk about coordinating multiple threads is a very different strategy, sort of, it's a very different interface for coordinating multiple threads. So far we've talked about these locks and the condition variables, where we're kind of explicitly saying how the threads should interact with each other. The locks are, you know, forcing us to take turns in an explicit way. And there's a kind of very different model called, which we'll call transactions, where we specify a set of operations and some machinery handles making it appear that those operations happen atomically, meaning they happen as if they happen all at once. They, of course, can't physically happen all at once generally. Like our code here is modifying multiple things in memory or on disk. It's going to need to do that in separate physical steps. But we're going to make it appear like it happens all at once, and some library is going to implement that for us. And this is commonly an interface you'll see in like databases. So databases have a way, very often, of doing something where you write a set of operations like this, and the database will figure out how to make it happen in a way where, if you're doing it for multiple threads, each one appears to happen all at once. Also, especially in the database context, transactions also implement some properties that are useful with respect to failures. So I talked about they appear to happen all at once with respect to if I'm doing two copies of this, there's no race condition. But they also usually provide what's called durability, meaning that if I am doing this operation here of, you know, editing, moving money from one account to the other, that even if there's a crash in the middle of trying to do this, somehow the system's going to make it appear as if either it completely didn't happen or it completely happened, not something in between. And the other property, the one where I said, like, if we're doing it for multiple threads, there's no kind of race condition type scenario where we see a partially done operation, it looks like it all happened at once, that property is called consistency. That we'll see. So we're going to talk about how to implement that sort of consistency slash atomicity property, that it's kind of all at once. And there's a bunch of strategies that you can use to do this, and that's kind of the elegance of this approach, that with locking, we're kind of very explicit about how are we going to coordinate these threads. Here, we're giving some library or some database all the freedom to figure out how does it implement this. And the simplest implementation strategy is we run one transaction at a time. We have a big lock, and we just say, we're doing one at a time. So that works. It's not great for our, you know, using multiple threads. So we want better versions of it. And there's kind of two different ideas for versions of it which allow us to do multiple transactions at a time on potentially shared data. So one idea is we can have a lock for every single object that's read or written. So if we look at our example here, I have this sort of pseudocode where I'm reading two accounts and writing them. So the idea is that as we're executing the transaction, we're going to go through those steps, and when we run get balance, we're going to acquire a lock on that each account's data. And we're not going to release that lock until end transaction. And by acquiring the lock, we'll ensure that no one else manipulates that account in between, so we should have, you know, it as if it happened all at once, because anyone else who's looking at that account will only see the version before we locked or after we locked of that account, and anything else we're accessing in the middle. Now, a problem here is that we talked about deadlock, and boy, we could have deadlock doing that, right? Because I'm just looking at instructions that weren't written with avoiding deadlock in mind. So commonly when this is implemented, they'll have a deadlock avoidance strategy, or not avoidance, a deadlock handling strategy of detecting that deadlock would happen or has happened, and then undoing all the operations and retrying later. In a database, this is pretty practical because you're implementing like the set amount function, so you could have it record what the old amount was so you can undo it if you detect a deadlock. And that is in fact something many databases do. Another strategy that you can use to implement this is that we can say, I don't want to do locking. Locking has us wait. And most of the time, we don't have race conditions. The race conditions are actually kind of rare in practice. So what we'll do is we'll run all the operations of the transaction as if everything's going to work out fine, but we won't do any writes yet. We'll just record the things we want to change. And then in that final end transaction step, we'll look at what we were trying to do, and we'll, acquire locks for all the changes and reads we're going to make. We're going to make sure that everything is still consistent. So if we write a particular balance, it still has the same balance when we finish the transaction. No one's stuck in between. And if no one's stuck in between, we just apply the changes. If they did, we retry. This is sometimes known as optimistic concurrency control if you take a more advanced database course. Now, we're not going to test on like the very specifics of implementing this transaction idea, but when you see that like this interface provides us with a lot of flexibility to find efficient ways of doing this, doing these operations in a way that kind of locks don't give us and condition variables don't really give us. So the idea is if someone who is implementing the transactions is smart, they can make it really fast and efficient and pretty easy to use. Questions about this transaction idea? Yeah. Question, how can it know that it encountered a deadlock? So there are well-known algorithms for this. Kind of the basic idea is, remember when we went over deadlock, we had those like graphs, those pictures we made. You can kind of make those programmatically and figure out if there's a cycle in them. If you take DSA2, you'll learn about, I think it's DSA2. We'll mention algorithms that can find cycles. The simplest way of trying to find a cycle is that you can get this from a depth-first search, probably, as kind of a side output. So you can look for a cycle in that. A simpler strategy is you can just kind of make a guess that if I'm trying to acquire a lock and it takes like more than 2 seconds, assume there's a deadlock and undo something. That's a sort of simpler strategy that probably works almost as well a lot of the time. Question, in a database, where is the bookkeeping information stored? It definitely depends on the database. Kind of the simplest thing is the database can keep it in memory until it's ready to finish the operation. But I could imagine databases, well, definitely there are databases which would like write it to disk somewhere, but just mark it as like not the final version somehow. Other questions? Okay, so that's all I have about sort of multiple threads. And we're going to go to a completely different set of topics. And we're going to talk about, well, maybe not completely different, because multiple threads was coordinating different program, different sort of functions on the same machine, basically. We're going to talk about coordinating things on different machines. We're going to expand on something you saw in CSO1, which was sockets. So you opened up a connection, and it looked like kind of a terminal file. It had this sort of idea that it was just a stream of data being sent from one machine to another. We're going to talk about what does that kind of look like at the sort of lower layers that implement that idea. And I'm going to call this idea the connection abstraction, that we have one program on one machine and one program on the other that have this thing we call a connection, where they can send things back and forth, you know, kind of like sending things, sending things to the screen or reading things from a keyboard. And the lower level tools that are used to implement that do not look like, on our current machines, that connection abstraction. They look very different. And I'm going to give it a kind of abstract model that's more like what kind of actual networks provide to the OS. And that's what we'll call a mailbox model. That we can kind of think of the things we send as not like a stream of data, but as these letters. And like a letter, we have kind of an envelope or the heading that tells us where the letter's supposed to go. And we give the letter to the network, and the network figures out how to deliver the letter to where it's supposed to go. And the network in our model is going to be what we call best effort, that there's not actually going to be guarantees. And sometimes the letter will get lost or delayed, and we're going to have to deal with that. That it's not 100% reliable on most of the networks we're going to care about. And I use the name mailbox because we're conceptually going to have kind of these mailboxes on each of our machines. We're going to have a mailbox of sort of outgoing things, so a bunch of letters where we want the network to take from us. And we're going to have a mailbox of incoming things, so the network's going to put something in this mailbox that we, as the OS, get to read and process. Those are all the letters that have come in, and these are not yet handled. Some questions on this kind of abstraction that we're going to have to build our sockets on top of. So that's our mailbox model, and we're going to build our connections on top of this. And to kind of remind us what a connection is, my kind of very abstract view of a connection is we have some operations to set up a connection. If you use the socket interface from Unix, you'd have a connect operation and a accept operation. So the party initiating the connection runs this connect function saying, I want to set up a connection with this machine, this program on this machine, actually. And the program runs this accept operation to accept that request to make a connection. And from that point in time, we have this kind of object that represents our open connection. And we can run send and receive operations on that to move data back and forth. So that's the abstraction we're going to try to implement on top of this mailbox model, where we have to send these kind of letters that are unreliable. Some questions on what I mean by connections. Yeah.
So shouldn't the final line be
received? Shouldn't the final line be received? The final question here, that should be send to the connection, not send to B. But what we're sending is for. So the idea is our send operation and our receive operation take one of these connection objects and the data to move, or return the data that was moved. Does that answer your question? Yes, and I did make a typo by writing the destination rather than the connection object that's going to abstract away where the data goes. Okay, so I introduced what we're going to go for. We're going to get these reliable, easy-to-use-ish connections out of the mailbox model. And we're actually going to have a few more steps. So I'm going to talk about kind of how we build up that whole connection functionality. To talk about that, I'm going to talk about sort of layers. And the reason I talk about that is because, well, the way network functionality is built is we take some simple functionality and we build more complex functionality on top of that. And there's a bunch of ways you might see this kind of analyzed. I'm using this sort of model where I have these four different layers that I think, five different layers, I can count, that kind of match the reality of the current internet. I say kind of, we'll get into some examples of where maybe they don't really match, but fine. And I would say, even though people disagree on exactly how many layers there are, these names are very common. And so at the top here, sort of our most sophisticated level, most usable level, we have what we call the application layer, where not only do we have connections, but on top of connections, we build useful applications. So we have SSH, which is built on top of connections like the sockets you used in CSO1, but we aren't just sending data. We have things that represent when the terminal's being shown, that handle logging in. We have all these extra meanings to the bytes that are being sent on that connection. We also have HTTP, so we're contacting a web server. We aren't just receiving a bunch of bytes. We have some way of knowing it's a web page, has a particular, it's an image or HTML. We have extra information and a way of sending that and receiving that and so on. So these application layers are going to be built on top of connections, and connections are implemented by what we'll call the transport layer. So built on top of the transport layer, which is going to be like your sockets, and these are going to implement the functionality of reaching a particular program. So one thing we have to worry about is that if I'm running four different SSH clients on my machine and something comes in for an SSH client, something needs to know which SSH client does that go to. And that functionality is going to be implemented in this transport layer. In addition, this is where we're going to implement that translation from the mailbox model to the kind of connection model where we have just a stream of data, it's reliable, we don't have to worry about things getting lost and so on. And that transport layer is going to be built on top of kind of our most obvious example of that mailbox model, which is going to be provided by what we'll call the network layer. So the network layer is going to provide us a way of sending these kind of things that look kind of like letters, and they'll figure out how to make it reach the right machine at least most of the time. But they don't know about sort of multiple related messages. They don't know anything about getting to a particular program on a machine, just to a machine. But they will handle dealing with getting the message across different networks. So the network layer is going to let me send a message from my laptop over Wi-Fi and somehow have it end up on a machine across the country that's obviously not connected to the same Wi-Fi. And the network layer isn't going to implement the actual operation of communicating over Wi-Fi or Ethernet or cable modem itself. It's going to rely on yet another layer to implement that functionality for it. So below the network layer, it's going to use calls to this link layer. And that's going to handle using a wire or radio that will usually be shared with multiple machines. Even if it's a wire, we have two machines on the wire. We need to know how do they coordinate. The link layer is going to implement all of that functionality. So it's going to handle getting our message across our local network. And the link layer that does that coordination, well, it needs to be implemented on top of some way to actually send data on the wire or over the radio. And we'll call that functionality the physical layer. So note that kind of each of these layers as we go up from the bottom here builds on each other. So the link layer is implemented by sort of using the physical layer's implementation of sending bits. The network layer is implemented by using the link layer's implementation of sending something across a local network. And the kind of advantage of this design is that we can replace the different things at each of these layers independently. And if I'm, say, implementing that transport layer, that reliability and connections, I don't need to worry about the details of how do I know how to get something to the right network going across the country. That's someone else's job. So questions about these different layers? Okay, so we have these different layers, and I had some special terminology for the layers themselves. There's also some terminology for messages that are handled at each layer. I'm going to try to use these terminologies, and I just want you to know what I'm referring to. So messages at the application layer, I don't have anything filled in here because it really varies. But at the transport layer, things that are sent there are typically called either segments or datagrams. So segments are the name for something that's a connection, where we have like a stream of data. The messages that make up that stream that are sent on the lower layer are called segments generally. And datagrams is the term you'll see used for messages that are not part of a stream of data, but just kind of independent. You'll see the term datagram for that. On the network layer, when we're sending a message there, that message is called a packet. And when we're sending something just across a local network in the link layer messages are called frames. And as we'll see later, basically we're going to put a segment in a packet in a frame. We're going to wrap these around each other. So we'll have a frame that contains a packet that contains a segment that contains some application data. Questions about this terminology? Yeah.
Sometimes frames are used inside of programs. What's different in the use of frame in this case than the use of frame inside of like program?
So the question is, you've seen the term frame used other places. So I would say, unfortunately, the term segment and frame are also used in other places. And might have different meanings there. And if you're seeing it used inside a program, probably it has a different meaning than this very specific one.
As in functionally, right, like if a frame contains the data, the segment is so functionally, are these definitions of frame and segment similar to what we've already seen?
So question, are these definitions of frame and segment similar to what we've already seen? Seen where? In terms of program memory, no. Unfortunately, no. The network people have their own mostly non-overlapping terminology. Like, they're the same in the sense that they're a frame is a single set of stuff that goes together, but that's a very minor similarity. Okay. So now that I've introduced our layers, let's go to our big problem we're going to try to solve, which is what the transport layer does to implement the functionality of reliability, and kind of having a stream of data rather than individual little messages. And there's a bunch of things we're going to have to deal with, and these are kind of limitations of the network layer. The network layer that the transport layer will handle. So this is all things our mailbox model is going to allow to happen. They're going to allow letters, those messages, to be lost. They're going to allow them to be delayed and changed in order. We can send them in one order and receive them in a different order. They're going to be limited in size. We aren't going to be able to send like a limited amount of data in one of those sort of letters. And they can also occasionally be corrupted. And these are all things that are going to be problems with that best effort model. There's nothing's guaranteed. Our transport layer that's built on top of that is going to want to handle it. So first, I'll talk about how do we handle messages being lost. So what I mean by that is that we're going to have, my example is machine A sending stuff to machine B. Machine A sends, the meeting is at 12 p.m., and in the good case, that message gets to machine B, it processes it. In the bad case, the network somehow loses track of the message. And with this as it is, we have a problem. And the problem is that no one actually knows anything got lost. Machine A, as far as what it's seeing here and here, it looks exactly the same to machine A. And machine B, as far as what it's seeing here versus here, it looks exactly the same. So machine B can't tell machine A tried to send it something, and machine A can't tell that the thing it sent didn't get there. So we need to change something to fix that. And the most common thing that will change is that we'll change what machine A expects to see. So machine A right now expects to see nothing other than that it sent something, apparently. And we'll change that by having machine B send something back when it receives something. So this means that now those two scenarios aren't identical. That if machine A doesn't get something back, it knows something is amiss, and will handle that situation by having machine A wait for a bit for what we'll call a timeout. And if that, at waiting for a bit, it doesn't see that acknowledgement, which is what our name for that reply from B will be, it's going to just send it again. Yes?
How can they be sure that machine B's response doesn't also get lost?
How can we be sure that machine B's response doesn't also get lost? We cannot. So what should we do about that? So I'll give, there's four answers here, so why don't you all think about that? Would like some more time? OK. Okay, so who thinks we should do A, that machine A should send, say that it got it, okay? B, that machine B should figure out to send got it again, okay? C, that machine A should just resend the message on its own, okay? None of these, so there's something else we should do, and no clue. Okay, so we have a mix. We have a plurality saying C, and I think C is the best solution, and it's the most typical solution. The other things are viable still. So having machine A send an acknowledgement of the acknowledgement, that's something we can do, but we run into this problem that we have the same issue with that message, and we eventually need to stop acknowledging things and have give up. So we can absolutely do that, but we can't keep doing it forever. But it's not completely unreasonable. B, we could have machine B resend it on its own. For this to make sense, we need to have machine B kind of have some idea when should it do this. Because kind of, if we don't have any restrictions on that, we're just saying that when machine A sends something, machine B keeps sending back the acknowledgement forever. So it needs to now have some reason that machine B is going to know to stop doing that. We could imagine some ways of making that happen, like maybe we say machine B keeps sending it until it gets a new message from machine A, or something like that, but we need some sort of stopping condition, and it's not clear in this problem what that would be. Yes?
Doesn't machine A not even know that it got to machine B, like, anyway, so why would option B make sense? Because then it would, that's presuming that machine B got it in the first place.
So a question, why would option B make sense? Because machine A doesn't know in this case that machine B got it. So that's, I think, the biggest point in favor of C is that if we look at this, what machine A sees here, it's the same as what machine A sees here. That as far as machine A is concerned, it actually has no way of distinguishing this case where the acknowledgement got lost from its original message getting lost. There's nothing changing that in this picture, and even if we implement the strategy in B, unless we're resending the got it soon enough, probably there would still be no way of distinguishing it. So, kind of by accident, we're going to implement the strategy in C even if we're not trying. That because we implemented the logic to resend if we don't get an acknowledgement, that's what's going to happen anyways. We're going to resend anyways. So we've kind of already written that logic. And that's why I think it's probably the best option, is because, well, we kind of are doing it anyways. Even if we do these other things, we're still doing the thing in C because machine A kind of has no reason to know it's in any of the other situations. So questions? And I guess an observation that might, yeah, sorry.
How would B know the difference between, like, a repeat of the message because there was a fail to send it back to machine A versus, like, machine A intends to send the message two times? It's the same message gets sent two times.
So the question is, how would machine B know if it receives the message again that it's, you know, not intended to be a duplicate? And the answer is that it wouldn't, so we're going to have a fix for that later. But we're going to have to add something to the message to make that not happen. I guess the preview is what we'll add is probably a counter. Yeah?
Can accuracy also be the solution if the message?
Question, would answer C be the solution if the message shouldn't get through from A to B? Yes, answer C is how we already said we're going to handle that situation. And that's why it's kind of free. We're doing it regardless. So something that might disappoint you about this strategy is that we can keep sending the message back to B forever. And we will never be sure if B ever got it. That is a possible scenario. And in practice, we're not going to keep sending it forever. We're going to give up eventually. And when we give up, well, we're not going to know, just kind of inevitably, did it get there? And that's just an unfortunate problem with this kind of scenario, that because we don't know if individual messages got there, you know, we ultimately, you know, if we don't get a reply back, we can't know what really happened. Did our message get there? We didn't get the reply. Or did our message not get there? We won't know, and that's how it is. Yeah?
Is it completely arbitrary how likely it is to get a message across and just the subsequent got a message back?
So question, is it completely arbitrary how likely it is to get a message across and the message back? So it's not arbitrary, but what we're representing with messages getting lost are things like the Wi-Fi signal goes bad. So there are things that are not really in our control and, you know, are going, you know, not necessarily related to anything we're doing. Other questions? Okay, and yes, someone brought up the issue that we need to handle getting the message twice. That is something we need to handle somehow. You know, simplest way is we assume that A never sends duplicates. The other way is that we can say, you know, this is message one, and figure it out that way. So another scenario that the mailbox model gives us is that messages can be delayed and reordered. So they can be delayed because, you know, sometimes the network is slow, and reordered because sometimes one thing will be delayed and the other things will not be, and we need to handle that. So one example of things being delayed is that while something gets delayed, machine B eventually gets it, and, you know, maybe we send it twice. That could happen. And that should be fine. We've already handled this kind of for free by handling lost messages. Because this looks exactly like the scenario to be where this acknowledgement got lost. And A just needs to realize that getting two acknowledgments doesn't mean anything's wrong. Questions? Scenario? Yes. So your question is, if A is to handle getting these extra acknowledgments, you know, that worked in this case because they were for the same message that was sent multiple times. What if they're not? We're going to talk about that later when we talk about messages being limited in size. The simplest way we could handle that is by only sending messages with long gaps in time between them. So even if they're delayed, they shouldn't be delayed that much. But yes, we'll need a better solution for that. And we'll talk about it when we talk about messages being limited in size, because then we'll need to send multiple messages for one thing. Yeah?
Is there also like a way to identify messages so like machine B can know that it was resent, basically?
Is there a way to identify messages? We could add one, and yeah, the preview of our solution is that we'll add a counter. Yes, oh, and we can also have the acknowledgments being delayed. That results in basically the same scenario. Yeah.
Does that mean we can have a similar counter for the got it message as well? So like, we would have an ID of one for the first meeting of 12 p.m. and also the same ID for the first got it
Does that mean we could have a counter for the acknowledgement messages? Yes, and that is in fact what we will do. We will have, say, got one instead of got it, basically. And to illustrate while we'll do that, we'll talk about messages being limited in size. So to deal with that, that means we're going to need to send something that we would, that's logically one message across multiple messages. Or if we think of our sockets, right, you're writing, you can write megabytes of stuff to a socket. We can't actually send megabytes at a time over the typical network layers we use. So we will split the message up into pieces, send each of them separately. But we need to deal with the scenarios people have brought up where, oh, we can have things be sent multiple times, and we need to realize that the message we want to reconstruct, you know, doesn't duplicate one of the pieces. And, you know, also we need to realize if we see acknowledgments, we need to know which messages they're for. So what we'll do is we'll mark the pieces of the messages that are outgoing. So we'll say this is part one, this is part two, and that means no matter the order they're received in or how many times they're received, machine B can reconstruct the original full message. And we also need to deal with acknowledgments sort of getting messed up. So we had an issue where someone brought up, oh, if we see two acknowledgments, we need to know if they're for the same message that was resent or two different messages. So we can do that. And we'll just do that by putting those part numbers in the acknowledgments. So then A will realize, oh, maybe I got an extra acknowledgement. It knows that's from things being delayed or something like that. But it can figure out where all the parts acknowledge, not just, you know, did I get two acknowledgements? I want to see, did I get an acknowledgement for part one and for part two? Questions about our, you know, sort of labeling message parts. Yeah?
Does it say in the message how many like parts there will be, or is it probable like the last parts missing?
Question, does it say how many parts there will be? We're talking very generically, so it could. For something like TCP, which implements sockets, it doesn't really because you know, you can just keep adding stuff to send, right? So it's, there is no limit on the parts, and we just figure out whether we need to send more things by figuring out, is everything acknowledged yet? If not, keep going. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so there's one last issue we didn't deal with, which is that messages can be corrupted. So this is one case where my analogy to letters kind of breaks down. We assume if a letter is in an envelope, like the things in the envelope don't change, but the reality is we're sending our messages over things like radio or wires, and they can have physical faults that result in bits changing when they're not supposed to. So we need to deal with sending something over some, say, unreliable Wi-Fi, and sometimes one of the bits gets flipped. Or something else happens to make the message contents be wrong. And the main solution for this is we're going to not just send a message, but we're going to send the message with some redundancy. And the most common form of this is that we'll take some sort of hash of the message, and rather than just sending a message, we'll send that hash and the message together. And when we receive this, we're going to recompute the hash, and if it doesn't match, we're going to pretend the message is lost. So a common theme you've seen here is we handle all sorts of problems by handling messages being lost and just delegating to that handling. That's what we're doing here. We're just going to act as if it's lost in that case, and we already have the handling to resend it. Hopefully it will not be corrupted when we resend it, and so that will handle this problem. Yeah?
So the sender updates the hashing algorithm, but the receiver
So the question is, if the sender uses a different hashing algorithm than the receiver, they would never be able to communicate? Yes. So we have to agree on what the hash function is. So generally, we'll have decided that in advance and be using a specific hash function.
And in the following updates, it would never be changed?
Yes, or if it is changed, there's something in the message saying which hash function you're using. And from that message, the receiver end can update its hash function. I would say usually the way this works functionally is that we'll send a message which is something like version 3, you know, hash, other data. And like when we want to update the hash function, we'll change it to version 4 and the new hash and so on. And we'll just have different versions of message type message formats we use. That's the most common way that you'll likely see this implemented, is that we'll just, you know, we'll have different message formats and we'll have like a version number or something like that to indicate which one we're using. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, what's the purpose of hashing it if you can just send the message twice? Saving space. Yeah. What is a checksum a kind of hash? Yes, a checksum is exactly the kind of hash I am talking about here. That. Other questions? Okay. So as the question alluded to, these hashes are usually known as checksums. Part of the name of that is that the many of the common forms are actually sums, meaning that they take the message, treat it as an array of integers, add those integers together, and that's the hash. But it could be kind of any hash function you like if you're designing protocol. Other shits. Okay. So we've dealt with all kind of our problems of the mailbox model. There's one other thing we want to do kind of to make this efficient, and that's that we actually want to deal with lots of stuff at a time. So if we're thinking of sockets, if you're connecting to a web server and downloading like a gigabyte of stuff, and we have to send this in small messages, we don't want to actually be doing the strategy of send one part, wait for it to be acknowledged, send the next part, wait for it to be acknowledged, for sending a gigabyte of stuff like across the country, that's going to be ridiculously slow. So instead, we want to send a bunch of stuff and have it all acknowledged together. But a problem with that technique is that we need to figure out how fast can we send the stuff. If we just send it as fast as possible, well, probably things are going to get lost more because we'll overload some network in between. So if you take a networking class, you'll likely learn a lot about what's called congestion control, which is not only kind of sending multiple parts together, but figuring out kind of dynamically how much you can send without things just getting lost all the time from overloading one of the networks that they're going across. So questions on this idea of sort of we're going to send multiple things, get multiple acknowledgments, but not too many. So we've talked a lot about how this transport layer does this reliability thing. And we're going to dig in more into these layers. Before I do that, I want to tell you, as I alluded to earlier, that these layers are kind of wrong. And the biggest way in which they're wrong is that often we kind of have multiple application layers or other layers stacked on top of each other in some other way. So, for example, you've probably seen many URLs say HTTPS. This is HTTP, which is an application layer, something meant to run on top kind of connections, like your sockets, but rather than running on top sort of raw sockets that like you used in CSO1, it's running on top another application layer protocol called TLS, which provides sort of security features that runs on sockets. So we have two application layers and then a transport layer and so on. Some current web browsers like using DNS over HTTPS, where they'll run DNS, which is an application layer. You can run directly on top of those sockets, but they run it on top of HTTPS on top of TLS, HTTP on top of TLS. So we have more stacking. If you've transferred files to Portal, you might have used a protocol known as SFTP, and that's something that runs on top of SSH, and SSH itself runs on top of that sort of connection model. And if you've used VPNs, VPNs are basically running the sort of network layer on top of usually a connection. And in that network layer, you'll run your usual like web browser stuff. So we'll have like multiple instances of the network layer in this one set of sending stuff. Easy. Okay, so that's, just wanted to point out, yeah, that in reality, like, things aren't this clean. We have sort of other ways of stacking the functionality depending on what we're doing, especially like stacking different application layers on top of each other is actually very common today. Okay, now since we're talking about multiple layers, one thing that comes up a lot with this is dealing with how do we identify machines for each of these layers to use. And this is something that comes up pretty much no matter what layer you're at, because if you're writing something that uses the application layer, it ultimately needs to figure out how to tell the network layer where the messages go. So even if we never actually care about how we implement connections, we still need to know about how we identify machines and programs, because we need to set up our connections, even using this kind of nice high-level API to identify a program on a machine somewhere. And when we do this, we're going to deal with both names and addresses. And those are going to be distinct things in our network. And they're also distinct things that you've already seen when you're doing normal programming. So if you have a variable in your program, it's going to have a name. Like you might have a variable called counter. And you know from looking at assembly that in assembly, it doesn't have a name anymore, at least once it turns into machine code. Machine code, there's no name for that. But the machine identifies that variable by, for example, the memory address it's stored in. And we have this distinction between names and addresses. So names are kind of meant for humans to use to identify the thing, and addresses are going to be the form that's convenient for the actual implementation to use. And we're going to want to convert from names to addresses to actually do stuff. And we're going to have the same kind of distinction for identifying different machines on the network and identifying different programs on a machine. That we're going to have names, some of which you've seen, like www.virginia.edu, but that's not a form that's convenient for the network to use directly to actually contact that machine. So we're going to have an address form that is convenient where it's going to end up being numerical. Questions, this distinction. And as we'll see, or probably mostly next time, when we're actually sending stuff across the network, it's going to want addresses, so we're mostly going to send these addresses. And we have various different forms of addresses for different layers and different versions of those layers. So on my picture here, I said that the network layer, the thing that implements that mailbox model, we have, I list IP version 4 and IP version 6. Those use different kinds of addresses, which is, you know, have slightly different formats we'll talk about. I also have addresses that we need for identify machines at other layers. So this MAC address here, this is going to be what's used at the link layer to identify a machine on the local wireless network or on the wire network. We also need addresses there, and there'll be different kinds of addresses because different layers are using them. So next time we're going to talk, you sort of look at an example of how these layers actually get stacked sort of and have their messages contained within another, like I alluded to earlier. We'll look at that in more detail, talk about what are each of these layers doing.